Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine. Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. What's up, fam? Lucas here. I want to take a moment to announce a couple of things to all my new listeners on the podcast. Firstly, if you're looking to upgrade your brain function, whether that be through reducing brain fog, enhancing verbal fluency, improving confidence, motivation, drive, or even orgasm intensity, then check out my nootropics course, which can be found on my website at www.ergogenic.health. And you'll see at the top, it will say courses, where you can use the discount code BYB15 to save 15% off. In addition, I also have a sleep optimization masterclass and a testosterone optimization course that can also be accessed on my website. Again, you can use the same discount code BYB15 to save 15% off. Hey everyone, and welcome to yet another episode of the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today, I am joined in with Jacob, joining me in all the way from the UK, whom we sort of just connected online through like a Facebook group, I think it was, a Nootropics Facebook group, and we sort of started geeking out and sharing our experiences and things like that. So today's episode is going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be talking all things nootropics, brain hacking, philosophy, and things like that. So, Jacob, aka Bam, welcome to the show, man.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on this increasingly popular and successful, business and podcast you've got going on. I'm impressed with the people you've managed to get on the show. So, yeah, I'm really excited to be here, and I think it's doing a really important function as well. You know, we need things like this.
I appreciate it, man. Thanks for that. Cool. Great. Do you want to just sort of maybe like start out by giving my listeners a bit of a background into your story? Like, how did you get into nootropics?
Yeah, good question. I love answering it as well. Well, it started with the idea of hacking. The idea of hacking really resonated with me. And I thought that, you know, being able to control things that you're not traditionally allowed to, or, you know, able to control, it was just something that endlessly fascinated me. And computers were my first introduction to having control that you're not really allowed to have, to be honest. I got into computer hacking, and I never did anything wrong or immoral, but nevertheless, it's a dangerous path to go down. And at one point I was caught hacking my school system. So that went pretty badly. And I was meant to go to prison, honestly. So There was a point in my life where I said to myself, I can't continue doing this because I know that I will eventually, get caught doing something really bad, even though it's not necessarily immoral, or what I was doing, just having access to things. So, and I realized that I was able to remember things about the brain very well. So, almost like the drop of a hat, I just said to myself, well, now I'm interested in neuroscience and seeing what I can do with the brain. And people only ever talk about changing their brain when it comes to recreational drugs. That's the kind of biggest, most pertinent way, I think, that the obvious way that people talk about it, in my experience at that point. And I thought, well, there's no reason why they have to be, of this nature, hallucinating things and experiencing things. That it could be cognitive, you could have revelations about your newfound intelligence, and that really caught my eye, caught my attention. And so I distinctly remember, I went to university, and for the first year of university, I was learning about psychology, because I found very interesting, and women's psychology and objectification and stuff. And then I realized, oh, hang on, if I could hack a brain like a computer, I would want it to be as intelligent as possible. So, then I thought, well, what have we done to do that? What have we done as a human race to enhance our brain? And it turned out basically not all that much, really, on the grand scheme of things. There hasn't been huge changes. You don't hear people saying, I'm now IQ 190, things like that. And I thought, well, that's kind of peculiar to me. So, and that's when peptides became exciting. And then the rest is, history, really. But hacking things is very fascinating to me. And that's what introduced me to nootropics. Cool. And peptides, that was special to me because I realized that anybody, an individual, anyone could just go out and get whatever peptide they wanted. And so their safety profile as well just meant it was a winner. It was a game changer. And I continued down that road, and I have done ever since.
Man, that's awesome. So we'll get into peptides soon, but I want to sort of recap and hone in on, maybe let's give our listeners a bit of a snapshot, because a lot of them may not even know what nootropics are. And I know we've been personally experimenting with them for many years, but do you want to sort of maybe give like a bit of context as to like what nootropics are and how they became popularized?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, nootropics are, they mean mind turning. That's the kind of, definition of the word, what it's referring to. So, and although the term mind turning is what it means technically, it also is referring to compounds that are able to increase an aspect of your cognition whilst not giving side effects, whilst not giving, inherent downfalls to the way that they work. They have to be kind of safe. You can't overdose on them very easily, things of this nature. So they're actually referring to a certain kind of chemical that is safe to use, you can take repeatedly, and that manages to enhance cognition. But it's not necessarily reliable. It doesn't necessarily have to work in everyone. But yeah, that's what nootropics are. I prefer to use the term cognition enhancing compounds, because you have less restriction in what you can refer to, and people land up battling over the semantics of things, which is kind of boring. So yeah, and that's the general idea of nootropics, in a sense, is things that enhance your cognition that are safe. And there's so many available. They can be natural or synthetic. That's important to know. Or both at the same time. But it started off with paracetam, and that paracetam finding spawned a whole family of different compounds. And this paracetam family is like the Rothschilds of nootropics. They have complete monopoly, really, on even research that is done today that looks at an overview of how you can enhance cognition. They will refer to the racetam family. They'll refer to how big it is and things. And it dominates a lot of scientific and academic perspectives are just dominated by the racetam family to some degree. But also modafinil. That's also very domineering in how people are, how academia goes forward. So, yeah, that's how it started. I think that was in the, when was it, the 70s, early 60s, before then?
Yeah. What was his name? I think it was Corneliu Georgia, like a Romanian.
Yeah, that's right. I don't particularly like a lot of the state of nootropics at the moment, so it's not of extreme interest to me, to be honest, because I think they can be revamped completely. Mm. So, but yeah, these are important people nonetheless. Definitely. Mm. So yeah, that's the
Yeah, so with the racetam, so like when I do a lot of, you know, research, it's funny to see how they use, like, for example, piracetam is the lead material, and then they compare, you know, how they compare certain substances to it. And I've seen like a few fairly novel sort of like herbals or other like compounds that they use to literally compare the anti-amnesic effect. Yeah. Have you seen much research of like any substances that sort of compare at all?
Yeah, it's true. They compare a lot of the racetam family to piracetam to see how much better it is, you know, because they all take the piracetam structure and enhance it. But it's also used to evaluate the nootropic potential of, you know, everything, basically from natural stuff to, like magnetic or electrical stimulation as well. They will also see how it compares. And it's an important baseline to have. But, it's something that's established in rats more than it is in humans, right? So it may not be the best idea to do that if you are going to compare things in humans, because racetams, they can be hit or miss, you know. But in rats, it's very reliable at improving memory and preventing memory loss. Mm. But, yeah, hypomnesiacs, they're also called. But the problem with anti-amnesiacs is that they try and see if they can prevent memory loss, right? But that's not what nootropics are about totally. They're about improving memory beyond baseline, you know, and this idea that going beyond baseline and maintaining your baseline, that's something I think people confuse. And, you know, nootropics are about actually going beyond what you normally would be able to do, you know, and achieving all the different possibilities of your brain power instead of just achieving the best one that you can with your current brain, I think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, piracetam has changed the world in the respect of being able to give a standardized and well-studied, kind of well-acknowledged, definitely, form of brain enhancement. And it spawned, I think, the commonplace view in researchers that if you have something that enhances cognition, it's likely to influence this neurotransmitter, this chemical signaling molecule called glutamate. And I've seen in papers, both recent and old, that they say, you know, the standard way of thinking is that if it enhances cognition, it will improve or modulate in some way the ability for glutamate to function. And to me, that was saying, oh, that's big news, because a lot of people think it's not glutamate, you know, it's actually choline, which... Yeah, but I'm probably getting ahead of myself here. I don't know how much people know about these terminologies.
That's the thing. We'll take a step back and we'll break down for our listeners to understand more about the neurotransmitters. So, like, you just touched on one of them, glutamate, which is like the primary excitatory, whatever. But let's go through all of them and give them like and explain them from a pretty like basic term, because I know your stuff.
Yeah, I think so. It may be different to a lot of other people's kind of knowledge, however, but yeah, the building blocks of your thinking could be argued to be these neurotransmitters, right? And, you know, neuro refers to the neural cells, and transmitter is moving, right? It's the transmission of information. And that is done via these chemicals. And you can transmit different information with different molecules, right? So with glutamate, we're transmitting stimulating information, but it has a lot of different receptors. So it can mean slightly different things for each receptor, very different things. And, you know, we have things that are mostly used to communicate forms of emotion, forms of cognition, you know, attention and awareness. So we'll go through them, right? So dopamine. Dopamine is used to regulate your muscle movements, and it can be both inhibitory, so it will dull the activity of neurons, as well as stimulate the activity of neurons. And dopamine is confusing for that reason, because it can regulate your muscle movements. It can also regulate your mood. It can regulate all many different aspects of your mood, and also communicate with other neurotransmitters. And it also controls your ability to have planning and organizing yourself, regulating your behavior and storing things in your head, manipulating them in your head. And, you know, as well as a lot of kind of primal instincts as well, you know, sexual motivation, aggression, all of these, you know, that's a huge range of topics. And of course, there are other molecules that will also do the same thing. So it's important not to, you know, say, oh, I'm irritable, therefore I don't have enough dopamine or something of that nature. Although, you know, there are definitely trends. But yeah, so the important thing to remember with dopamine, I think, is that when people try and fix or modulate or improve their dopamine, is that there's a different way forward to improving your emotional aspects of dopamine function and your cognitive aspects of dopamine function. I'll probably get into this later, actually. But the next one I would say would be serotonin. Serotonin, also very interesting, has a huge role across the entire body. It's, most of the receptors are found in the gut, but it has a huge role in our ability to perceive time and regulate our perceptions. Of course, I'm sure a lot of people know this, you know, all pretty much, well, a lot of the hallucinogenic substances are done, they use serotonin to do that. And because of their ability to influence our perception, they have the ability to change the way that we respond to things and how creative we are, right? Our imagination is essentially, you know, fabricated sensations in a way. And that ability for serotonin to like alter our imagination and our perception is something that we could really use to enhance creativity. So I think there's a lot of potential with that when it comes to cognitive enhancement. And I've read that the receptor that causes hallucinations also manages to gate the ability for our prefrontal networks, the networks that deal with how we plan and organize and create and discern. So the plasticity of those networks are controlled by the same receptor that makes us trip. So, you know, there's a huge potential there, and it kind of explains why people microdosing on LSD and things can have benefits to their ability to be more resilient to stress and be creative. So I really like serotonin, and I think it would be really good to be able to, you know, improve serotonin so that we have a much better enjoyment from our perceptions, like our food, you know, socializing, having new experiences and seeing beautiful sights and things like that. It's I think it can help us be more appreciative by far. Another one, a neurotransmitter, is choline. Now, choline is an interesting one. I've recently changed my understanding about choline, but traditionally it's something that is heavily used in muscular junctions as well. So our muscle control, as well as our ability to pay attention and learn things. Now, learning is different to memorizing, right? Mm-hmm. To learn something is like to be able to pass and deconstruct the situation down so much that you can reconstruct it without having to memorize much. So it's a way of like making memory super efficient. If you learn something, it's because you understand it, you know? And so when they say in research papers, oh, we've noticed that rats learn better when they have more choline available, when their acetylcholine neurons are working better, suddenly they can learn better. I think there's a lot of cognitive elements there that are very deep that run into how well they can understand a situation and pass it and then walk away with a whole new understanding about their environment. So I think that's a really important chemical to pay attention to when you want to have a better ability to, you know, shift your attention and do higher order cognitive skills. And it, you know, what's interesting is that glutamate, the abundant excitatory neurotransmitter, has within its identity this ability to just stimulate acetylcholine. You can never separate glutamate from acetylcholine. Wow. So, you know, no wonder they say that traditionally glutamate would be the neurochemical that improves learning and memory, when it also has the ability to just, you know, boost acetylcholine levels to really high degrees. You know, I'm mentioning choline and acetylcholine interchangeably, but yeah, it's all acetylcholine. But yeah, and that's, you know, that's fascinating, because when people think that, you know, this molecule is using my acetylcholine because I need to have choline in order for it to work, right? Like with racetams, they say, oh, you know, this is an acetylcholine compound because I must have the resource required to use it. That's like, it's true, but it is primarily a glutamate compound, right? So it's just this one neurotransmitter influencing another. So, you know, it's important to not mix the two up. Another one, I say histamines. Histamines are really interesting as well.
Sure, yeah.
they can control a lot of aspects of our attention. And, you know, they're kind of similar to choline in that respect, but they do have a remarkable ability to change the structure of neurons and really powerfully influence inflammation and brain functioning to a really high degree. You can really switch the lights on with histamines. And it's a form of kind of stress response, you know, and it's, you know, a lot of compounds work by stressing the brain, but only in the way that is beneficial to our brain functioning. And it to me, it seems as though our endogenous stress molecules do two things. They kind of, they plasticize our brain, and then they also make that plasticizing work towards a bad thing, right? So more stress response, poorer ability to think clearly. So it's like they're just molding our brain to be more stressed. And if you can separate that ability to change the brain and the ability to make us more stressed, then what you've got then is a compounds that could just get all the goods without the bad, and increase the ability for the brain to change itself and modulate its structure. And a different structure is the essence of nootropics, in my opinion. So, noradrenaline, final one I'll go into. Noradrenaline, closely related to dopamine. And this noradrenaline has taken my fancy because it has this unique ability to change the interconnectedness of brain cells. So how well they connect from another cell to this cell. And there are certain ways, certain forms of connectivity between brain cells. There's the form of connectivity where it's talking to a very distant neuron, a very far away in a different lobe, doing completely different things. And then there's the form of connectivity where it's connecting to close by neurons. And it's that close by communications where lots of neighboring neurons are communicating very quickly. That form of communication is where very higher order, very intelligent functions reside. And it's, you know, it's one of my life ambitions to be able to increase this close quarters communication between neurons so that they exchange their messages very, very, very quickly. And you get very high powered information processing. And when it's very high powered information processing, it can happen very quickly, and it can get you very far in terms of, you know, how many steps you're doing mentally. And that communication is one that is decreased from hallucinogenics,
right?
Because creativity is almost the antithesis of this high processing, the opposite, the complete invertedness of this higher order close quarters communication that deals with things like working memory, which, you know, do you know working memory?
Do you mean the mechanisms or like the way in which it's...
What kind of memory it is?
Well, I don't know what they. How do they define like working memory? Is that like within like a 24-hour period, or
no? It's how many things you can keep in your head at any one time whilst still being able to manipulate them.
Right.
So if I showed you, like, have you seen those IQ questions where it's a bunch of shapes and then they say, you know, here's some shapes and here's another set of shapes. What's the next shape?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And there'll be a pattern that you have to try and find, and it'll look like gobbledygook, and it, you know, oftentimes just basically is. But yeah, that's the kind of memory that uses your working memory, because how many things can you put in your head and manipulate them to find a pattern? And that form of high intensity loading or stress on your brain, you know, that depends on this very close quarters, high speed neural communication that does not communicate with faraway neurons. And noradrenaline can alter neural networks to be far better at communicating to nearby neurons. Mm. So the upside is that you may have a higher working memory, but the downside, which means that you can hold more things in your head and solve more complex problems with working memory improvements, but the downside might be that you're not as good at creativity.
Yeah.
Right. That's difficult. And I've actually asked a famous scientist, what's his name? I can't remember now. The guy who wrote Drugs Without the Hot Air, you know, famous guy who talks about the legalization of weed and LSD and DMT, and he thinks that a lot of drugs should be made legal. And I asked him his thoughts on people who take LSD who may be decreasing their ability to store things in their head and manipulate them with working memory. And he said, well, maybe bank accountants and bankster people shouldn't be using it because they need their working memory, people who have high functioning jobs. So I guess clearly it is this unresolved paradigm where you will sacrifice on creativity if you have a higher working memory. But hopefully we'll get around that, you know. Mm. But yeah, those are the kind of basic building blocks.
Awesome, man. No, great summary there. There's a lot of information for our listeners to unpack. So we'll sort of maybe get into, so now that we've obviously broken down the neurotransmitters, I think we sort of skipped GABA, but we can, do you want to maybe explore that one there finally?
Yeah, sure. So GABA is very, very important. It's important to your entire brain. It's a bit like glutamate in that your entire brain relies on it immensely, you know, and the entire brain uses it in order to function properly. So GABA is a huge building block. It is like, if you didn't have GABA, it would be like having no negative numbers in maths. You know, the whole idea would just fall apart. I mean, you need GABA. And what's interesting about GABA is that inhibition, the idea of inhibition is very, very important, because a thought is much like a constructed sort of castle or a statue. You know, you're carving away parts of it in order to make this definition, right? And an intelligent thought is like having this a structure to it. And, you know, GABA, inhibiting neurons, is like carving a structure, right? So when you have an intelligent thought, it's like you've pieced together two distant ideas and you found a relationship and you've made something that's intelligent, right? That requires inhibiting all of the irrelevant information. So it's very, very important to allow yourself to recognize an intelligent thought. And if you can't recognize it, you haven't properly had it. So with GABA, it's important to have a strong, healthy GABA system, because it is your building block to carve an intelligent thought. It's much like making a statue or a sandcastle. You've got to get rid of some of the sand to make the beauty, right? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that's how relevant GABA is to cognition. And what GABA is very, very powerful as well. So you can have huge amounts of damage to GABA neurons, and you can still have your core GABA functioning well, because there are these neurons that have this special, remarkable ability to fire at 200 times a second. And that's way faster than neurons were traditionally thought to be able to fire at. So if they fire at 200 times a second, they're basically interrupting signals before they've even reached their destination. So you can have a thought, potentially epilepsy is kindling, is happening. And then these inhibitory neurons fire so fast that it stops the epileptic seizure in its tracks. And that can happen. So GABA has loads of different ways of communicating with neurons. It can land up improving your social skills. It can land up clearing your head. It can improve your quality of life because it can get rid of all the stress that may have built up over decades of, you know, having a job. And, you know, and so it's got a lot of therapeutic potential. And a lot of people, it's understandable why a lot of people turn to benzodiazepines, because they do a remarkable job of being able to just get rid of all the issues that were in your head, you know, and it's a form of a kind of escapism in a way. But yeah, if we can find a way to kind of increase the functioning of GABA without forcing it so as to downregulate its ability, and eventually if you continue to force the GABA action, you lose the receptors and even the neurons, and eventually you'll end up with more issues down the road. So it's a huge therapeutic requirement to have a good GABA system, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've got that, but yeah, back on track.
Yeah. No, you did a remarkable job at summarizing GABA, and just a very, I mean, I felt like you brought that all together, and that was really clear. Probably the best description of GABA, and just in general, the neurotransmitters, did a really fantastic job.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, summarizing that, because you brought in elements of, like, you know, the philosophical side of things, and then the functionality, which I really like, which is cool. You sort of mentioned, I want to sort of go back to the concept of time, perception of time, because that fascinates me.
Yeah, that is, isn't it? Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I mean, we always complain that there's not enough hours in the day. Well, maybe there are, you're just not perceiving them correctly. You know. Yeah, it's really interesting. And for example, like flow state is a very complex phenomena. And, you know, a lot of people think of it as like a prefrontal thing where your prefrontal cortex shuts down and, you know, thereby related to dopamine in some respects. But flow state is not easy to pin down. But I'd say it does look like a lot of the ability for our brains to change its perception really seem to be related to serotonin. And, you know, in that sense, they build our understanding of our lives. And serotonin, I think, is something that can get kind of missed. And people don't realize that, you know, their life is filled with sensations. And, you know, I consider myself as someone who is dopamine, primarily dopaminergic, basically. And I think it's really easy to just miss the fact that, you know, you're meant to enjoy food. You're meant to enjoy a nice sunset, you know, and that's where serotonin comes in. But yeah, I don't know huge amounts about the ability for serotonin to alter our time perception. But I know that, it can be done all the time. And there can be some bizarre phenomena that serotonin can do, you know, absolutely bizarre.
Yeah. I want to sort of go into more about the... linking in the serotonergic system with the opioid, because I know the 2A sort of maybe like not so much the opioid, but like the enjoyment response and pleasure response.
Yeah.
And how it links there.
Yeah, that is really interesting. And I'm still trying to decide, you know, if serotonin is using the opioid system or if it has its own ability to assert a value, you know. Opioids are thought of as this universal value system that isn't particularly... sorry, one second. I just want to get rid of that noise. Okay. It's really frustrating. But yeah, people think of the opioid system as like the primary currency of enjoyment. And I do wonder if perhaps serotonin is providing, or not so much enjoyment per se, but like pleasure. And it's a big question as to whether serotonin has its own ability to make its own value and provide something that is similar to opioids and how it satisfies and is pleasurable, or if it is using the opioid system as its a way of triggering the satisfaction and enjoyment. But I think from a cognitive perspective, at least in terms of cognitive performance, it is quite important to steer away from the opioid kind of family of receptors, because they're quite problematic, you know. Yeah. And if serotonin has a way of using the opioid system, then that must mean that there is a way to make it so that you can enjoy the opioid system without having this the issue that opioids bring with it, you know, which is primarily a reduction in GABAergic inhibition. And opioids are really, really good at reducing the ability for GABA to, you know, inhibit glutamate activity in the way that I mentioned about those neurons that fire 200 times a second. It specifically stops those GABA neurons from working. But I think there's something special with serotonin, and there's even something special with tryptophan. Tryptophan is the precursor to making serotonin. So if you cut out tryptophan in your diet, it's an amino acid, then you land up getting depressed. It's just this universal kind of finding. And a lot of people thought that the effects of tryptophan were in making serotonin, but it actually has its own unique function on the microtubules, which are the structures that make up neurons. And they can bind to these structures, these scaffolding in neurons, and they can make those scaffoldings behave in completely different ways. So, you know, it's possible that serotonin may have a limited function and that it is perhaps its precursor that makes neurons behave in ways that are just so bizarre. They even interact with like quantum gravity and things, which, you know, and you start asking yourself, if consciousness is quantum, then maybe, you know, the serotonin system and tryptophan by extension is having this special ability to make our consciousness elevate into new dimensions. I mean, you know, sometimes hippies are right, and I'm keen to ensure whether or not they are. Like, that's important. But there is a strong link between serotonin and the opioid system, definitely. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to be contrived in experimentation. But if anybody is experimenting with new opioids or new serotonergics, please let me know. I'd love to find out. Sounds really interesting. It would save me on experimenting with them.
Yeah.
But there's some really interesting peptides, by the way. Oh, we haven't gone into peptides yet.
I can
mention it.
Yeah, we can get stuck into, because I know we had a few things we wanted to talk about. And in particular, we can probably start out with that one that you mentioned in the Facebook groups and things like that, the HAFGL.
FGL. Yeah. That's interesting stuff. Yeah, that is, in my view, it's kind of historical, really, because it's doing something that no other peptide has really been able to do, in my opinion, really, because the brain encodes your cognitive skills in three-dimensional space, right? You've got your temporal lobe over here, you've got your occipital lobe over here, and they do different functions, right? So if you've got a drug that's going from one area, well, that wants to influence the brain, and you want that drug to improve your ability to make plans, right? Executive functioning. That means you want that drug to go to the area of the brain that is influencing your ability to make plans, right? Which means that there's this huge dependency on this drug to move around in space in your brain. So it's got to just go from A to B. And peptides, a class of drug that seem very safe and very effective at changing signals that happen in the brain, peptides are not very good at moving around in the brain, traditionally speaking. So when people take Cmax or Clank to serve a function, to do anything, they are implicitly expecting it to be good enough to travel to the area of the brain that will serve the function that they want it to. And there have not been many attempts at ensuring through modifications, through, you know, other chemicals, just some way of ensuring a peptide can get to where it needs to go. You know, we simply take the peptide and hope for the best. And that's not how the brain works, unfortunately. You can't expect something to get to a very distant region of the brain that may have not very good blood supply or a very tough enzyme environment, or, you know, has so many neurons that it's difficult to move around them, you know, because it's so dense. There are all these difficulties that peptides have that people do not empathize with. So the hyaluronate FGL, the peptides that I've been, the HAFGL, the one I've been mentioning in the groups, that has this unique modification to it. And it's a remarkable modification that ensures, it doesn't guarantee, but it is a very contrived, purposeful effort to make those peptides go to where they need to go to improve cognition. unlike every other peptide that you can buy. So it's really, really important. And it's in my, that's why I consider it historic, because so, you know, we just don't actually have any data on whether or not these peptides can go to where they need to go and ensure that, and whether, how, you know, how much better they could be if they could get there with in high amounts. So this hyaluronate FGL is using a kind of taxi driver, if you will. The hyaluronate is like a taxi driving it around the brain, and it's so good at getting around the brain that the scans they've done in research papers show that it seems to get across the entire brain from the back to the front. It's all there. Wow. It's just soaking in this stuff. So obviously that has some, a lot of potential benefits to the different cognitive domains that we can improve. Perhaps we haven't been able to be better at planning from nootropics because we haven't been able to guarantee that they even get there, you know? Although the, in preliminary results, it doesn't seem as simple as that. But yeah, some people have been taking hyaluronate FGL. I haven't even mentioned what the FGL does yet.
Yeah.
So that the taxi driver is the hyaluronate, right? Yeah. And the FGL is the passenger, the drug. And so what the drug does...
That hyaluronic acid, is that the skin... Because I know there's a lot of skincare product. It helps with the collagen and stuff like that. What, is that the same you referred to?
Yeah, it is. Exact same. Yeah. This hyaluronate has is essentially scaffolding to the body. Right, it's a hugely abundant form of structuring tissues, and scaffolding has a lot of desirable qualities to being able to taxi drive substances around the body and brain. Scaffolding is strong. It can be, it can vary in length. You know, you can attach things onto scaffolding that help it attach other things onto scaffolding. You know, you can have linkers, joiners, and that's very desirable for compounds to modify them. So what I did, as has been done by many people before, only in research papers, not much further than that, is get a very small scaffolding of hyaluronate and then attach peptides onto it, multiple. So like just sticking them on there with a certain special form of hyaluronate. And if it's very small, then it gets around the brain very quickly. And of course, this scaffolding has its own receptors to move around. So it has these, you know, these neurons and brain and cells of all kinds just facilitating its moving. They're providing a highway, if you like, for the taxi to just drive up and down wherever it likes. And it is the same thing as that's found in skin supplements. And at first, you know, I was concerned because the hyaluronate is related to the ability for tumors to metastasize, right? And the more signaling you have of scaffolding, the more tumors feel confident to break away and form a new tumor somewhere else. But it turns out that this is either negligible or, I don't know, there's a huge conspiracy going on, because that you can buy very small hyaluronates from shops, you know, nearly all around the world. I mean, it's in skin supplements, it's in, you know, a bone repair as well. But it's fascinating. And, you know, the bigger the hyaluronate, the safer it is, generally speaking. But yeah, you will. It's in shops all around the world, and I'm sure it's going to be a bit like CBD, where it just explodes in popularity. So
if is this still, you're still referring to oral administration? Because now I'm curious to know whether this is still like the benefit of the hyaluronic is that when it's consumed orally, it's so. Or are you talking nasal or sublingual?
Well, hyaluronate is very flexible. It can be taken in multiple different ways. I'd be interested to know how people respond if they were to take skin supplement hyaluronate and they were to take it intranasally, for example. That would be quite, you know, interesting. But yeah, one of the brilliant things about it is that you can take it orally and it doesn't get broken down. It still does a perfect job of, you know, what its job is. And that does open up a huge field for compounds that must be intravenously injected, or, you know, you can't take sublingually. Suddenly you can take them sublingually. You could take them orally. You could even rub them on your skin and get absorbed that way without the need for DMSO or other cat piss smelling substances. So yeah, DMSO stinks. So I think it's a lot of opportunity, not only for our nootropic ambitions, but also for, you know, drug ambitions all around the world. And it does look that way. There are new papers every year saying how amazing hyaluronate is, and it'll be a $60 billion industry you know, by the end of the decade, these things. So yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah.
But FGL, and I haven't actually seen the interview with Ryan Smith. I've been looking for it. Is it on YouTube?
Because it's not released yet, but it'll be live in a few weeks, probably.
Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. Fantastic. Okay, well, I really look forward to that. And I'm, you know, hoping that he mentioned FGL, the peptide. The FGL peptide is very exciting, basically, mm-hmm. because it works a bit like sonoferam and uniferam. Mm. Do you know these nootropics?
Ampicines?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, spot on. Yeah, they are. And I love ampicines. And the AMPA receptor in general is just phenomenal. It's wonderful, really. It's called AMPA for reasons of scientific, chemical, molecular reasons, right? But it amplifies neurons. It's a pun, and they didn't even realize it.
Let's break that down. So you got NMDA and AMPA. So like, let's break them down as well.
Great. Yeah. Okay. So, you know, glutamate, the neurotransmitter that's so highly abundant in the brain, it has many different receptors, right? And one of them helps move potassium, and, you know, well, it modulates all the ions in the brain so that the salts, basically, you know, sodium, calcium, potassium, magnesium, and moving them into neurons will just make them fire, right? So if you open up all of these receptors that move ions across, that will just make them fire, right? So because they get charged, because of these salts have charges to them. And those receptors are the AMPA receptors. Mm. They move ions across. And, you know, that sounds as though it could be dangerous. And I agree, AMPA receptors moving ions around, making neurons fire like crazy, could be very dangerous. It's true. However, they do serve a function, and that function is used all the time. You can never escape from moving ions around. And the ability to do that delicately in a way that agrees with how neurons operate normally is the pinnacle of therapeutic potential in many ways. And that's why so much research has been done on being able to use these AMPA receptors. Because a lot of it comes down to which neurons are firing and which ones aren't, right? A lot of disease just kind of comes down to that in terms of the brain. But let's move on to NMDA receptors.
Yeah.
NMDA receptors are like the gatekeepers for learning. They're big, angry people who could do you a massive favor, but they could also punch you to the ground. You know, they're standing at the gates saying, yeah, beyond these gates are all your wildest dreams of learning, of intelligence, of deduction. But we're only going to let you pass if you do the right thing at the right time, basically. Mm. If you don't do the right thing at the right time, we're not letting you through. In fact, we're going to turn you so far away, you'll never get here and to pass these gates, you know. So that's, I'm saying this because a lot of people don't like NMDA receptors because they see it as the bane of their existence, because it's where the too much excitation comes about, too much activity. It's just way too much. And you land up with brain fog and you can't think clearly. And that would be because of NMDA receptors. But at the same time, the same token, the same ability for them to stop you thinking properly is also what allows them to make you think very, very clearly, if they're used correctly. So NMDA receptors, they let calcium into neurons, and calcium is very, very stimulating. And if you have a few too many calcium molecules in your neurons, then that neuron could die. So the level of NMDA activity is what's important. And it explains why a lot of people will get benefit from things like memantine, because there's just a slight disbalance between their glutamate and their GABA, and it means they have to rebalance it with things like memantine, which is just an NMDA blocker. It's also a dopamine agonist as well, which complicates things. But so NMDA is a huge, huge kind of infamous, almost, I think, receptor. But it doesn't stop there. See, glutamate has this like secret up its sleeve that not many people really know about. And it's got this secret ability to just change how your brain operates in the long term. And that's, they don't have a created name really, metabotropic glutamate receptors.
Oh, yep.
And they're very, so like meta, Go-tropic. Yeah. It's a bit like metabolism, and your metabolism is something that kind of, you know, it's a very broad function that it stretches over a long period of time, you know, and it will control very broad aspects of how your body works. You can see these as like the metabolism of your glutamate, because they interact in such a broad, long-term sense, because they can influence how glutamate is handled. They can influence how GABA is handled. They can influence just about anything that they want to, really. And these receptors, these metabotropic glutamate receptors, they are very, very similar. So although there's many different groups of them, there's many different kinds of metabotropic glutamate receptors, they are so similar in structure that it's difficult to make a drug that influences just one of them, right? Because they're just so identical. You know, you just can't make a drug that just interacts with one. And that leads to difficulties. And it's probably the reason why not many people know about them is because there isn't a nootropic on the market that is primarily known for doing that. But aniracetam, for example, is a racetam that manages to break down into something that will then influence metabotropic group 2 glutamate receptors.
That's the same. I think that's the same that LCAR epigenetically upregulates. I don't know if you've seen, because when I use LCAR, I do seem to get that. I don't know if that's coming from the noradrenaline effect or
or the mitochondria effect. I think it's got a huge mitochondrial effect as well.
Yeah,
and it somehow like influences nerve growth factor.
Yeah,
which is quite astounding. I don't know how many people actually get increased nerve growth factor from it, because I'm kind of skeptical. It's amino acids, you know. You shouldn't be able to have such powerful abilities, but I've been wrong before about amino acids, you know, and their ability to do things.
Have you looked into, because I know you mentioned memantine, but one of my crazy friends actually got his hands on MK-801. Have you
heard? Oh my gosh, what was he thinking? Oh my word. Christ, does he want to be a rat? Oh, not even rats like it.
I know.
No, that is crazy. He must have some really bad GABA problems or glutamate problems. So tell me, go on, spill the beans. So this is the first report I've heard of MK-801.
Now, this guy's got a PhD in neuroscience, He actually invented the polysomnography, the sleep software. But anyway, he somehow...
Oh, Jack Alocca.
You probably know him.
Yeah, interesting guy. Yeah. Well, what was he doing with that?
It was a while ago. I think he was with one of his friends and it just sounded horrific. Just like, I can't imagine. Like, what do you think mechanistically, like, what do you think that would do to the... Because we know it's a powerful NMDA antagonist. What do you think that would do?
What I think that would do is, it would really have no finesse. It would just block all the signals that are even just vital to normal brain functioning. I think that would give highly dissociated states. I could imagine, you know, a lot of contrast in neural activity in certain regions of the brain. There would be some regions that would be completely shut off, other regions that are only a little bit shut off. And so you just get this very distorted, warped experience. And it just wouldn't sound very fun at all, honestly. The biggest thing I think with NMDA receptors and a lot of different kinds of drugs is like the details, the minute ability for them to interact with the receptor. So like, how quickly they bind to the receptor and how quickly they disassociate from the receptor. That's the kind of thing that is a big dictator in how therapeutic or what the kind of effects will be. And I just, you know, MK-801 is not designed to have finesse, you know, and it's just the kind of thing that where you potentially completely, you could collapse, you might just fall asleep, you might have no memory whatsoever of even buying it. And you just see this powder going, oh, that's weird. I don't remember buying MK. whole range of issues.
Yeah. So I want to go back around that NMDA receptor and talk about magnesium. Cause like a lot of my listeners would take magnesium. So do you want to explain what's the interaction there?
Yes. So magnesium is very, very important. It's got the, So I'd say I would begin by talking about the timing of neurons firing. So when you have two neighboring neurons, the one of them will fire and it will lead. So when I say fire, it means that there will be an electrical polarity and that creates this traveling current of electricity. And then it zooms to the end of the neuron and then it will release neurochemicals. And then those neurochemicals will then trigger the same, you know, electrical polarity, and then it'll keep going on and on. And magnesium is a way, it's like a coincidence detector, because it tells, it helps neurons identify if a neuron is firing randomly or if it's firing in a way that is important. So, and it does this through the timing of neurons. So the timing will discern whether or not it's responding to a neural action potential or a neural firing appropriately, or if it's just firing randomly. So there's, you know, neurons can fire randomly or they can have a coherent response. And magnesium is a way for neurons to stop the randomness of neural activity from dominating the whole brain. So magnesium blocks, it's a blocker. It will stop NMDA from working, right? And it will unblock the NMDA receptor if there are AMPA receptors working as well. So if there's going to be an action potential, or if there is one, and then it actually triggers the whole neuron to fire, if that happens, then the magnesium will disassociate and then it'll allow for that NMDA receptor to work, which then leads, it opens the gates that I was mentioning. And it says, you know, this neuron has now received a coherent, appropriate, well-timed signal. So I suppose really the best thing to understand is something called spike-timed dependent plasticity, which sounds pretty complicated, but it's basically a way for neurons to tell if their activity is because of a previous neuron. So a one that was, you know, helps it get fired. That's funny. So yeah, and you know, if the magnesium doesn't disassociate from the NMDA receptor, then it means that it hasn't thought that that signal it received was important enough, and it was just a random signal that wasn't helpful in cognition. So if you don't have enough magnesium, that means you get neurons that will end up firing at even whimsical signals, right? So even ones that aren't very important. And what's kind of surprising is that if you give rats magnesium L-threonate, for example, yeah, they will develop a higher synaptic density. And that higher, so they'll have more connections between neurons, which allows for more thoughts, which allows for higher cognition, better memory and learning. And, you know, you kind of think that magnesium, by inhibiting NMDA signals, the gatekeepers of learning, you would think that there wouldn't be an increase in neural connections. You'd think that if you stop NMDA from working, you're going to stop learning from happening. You're going to stop new synapses from working, because NMDA is the gatekeeper for all the learning and intelligentness and intellect. So if you stop that from working, you'd think you'd stop, you know, better learning. But the nuance of the brain is not about quantity, it's about quality. And if you allow for neurons to better be able to detect whether there is some coincidental firing, whether there's some random nonsensical firing that's going on, or if it's a very appropriate, well-organized thought, if you will. If you help neurons detect the good signals from the bad signals, then they land up making more synapses and they have a better ability to change their structure. So I recommend that people understand the spike time dependent plasticity. It's a nice kind of logical concept that it will really help people understand the general workings of the brain. And, you know, if you look at a graph then of STDP, as it's called, then spike time dependent plasticity, then you'll see, oh, it's about the timing, you know, and if one neuron fires after another neuron at the right time, then it must mean that that signal is being carried appropriately across neurons, and then the learning happens. But if it's the wrong way around, then it won't. But yeah, that's the kind of general understanding of magnesium. It's described quite often as a coincidence detector, because it can help neurons tell if there's some stochastic firing or random firing to a very well-ordered kind of constructive series of firing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's.
But I still need to be re-educated on this. I did this so many years ago, and I've been so embedded in pharmacology that a lot of the kind of basic stuff is almost out of the other ear now.
Yeah, that's. I mean, that's the first time I've heard of it being known as the coincidence detector. So,
oh, really?
Okay. I think maybe now you've got that. You can claim that quote.
No.
So, we can sort of transition back into some of the peptides. You listed off the GSB106 as well.
Yes, GSB106. Have you come across? It's
brand new to me, so that's a shock.
yeah, it is, you know. Well, I suppose that's brilliant then, really. Yeah, so GSB106, I found out about it like 4 years ago, and I saw that it had a similar kind of ability for magnesium threonate to increase the synapses, the connections between neurons, to a very high degree. And I thought, oh, that's quite special. And then I learned about its structure and the fact that it came from Russia. In fact, the same institution that made Neurpept and CMAX, or that researched it heavily.
And Bromantane.
Oh, yeah. Oh, blimey. Yes. Yeah. Rocket fuel with a diamond attached onto it. That's basically Bromantane. It's hilarious that, you know, you can add bits of diamond onto peptides and compounds and they suddenly have completely different qualities. But yeah. GSB106, it's designed based on the BDNF structure, the well-known, well-famed, well-loved BDNF. But the scientists began to notice that the whole protein is not involved in every receptor interaction, right? Only a part of the protein is actually being used when it binds to a receptor. So they said, well, what if we just take the part of the receptor that's used? So they went on a mission to identify which amino acids are involved in the ability for the BDNF protein to stimulate the receptors, right, that it interacts with. And then they managed to reduce the number of amino acids, and they found it was, you know, it was a string, and then it was just two amino acids. And that just two amino acids seemed to be enough to stimulate the receptor. You know, BDNF is a huge protein. And then they found that you could just only actually use two amino acids to get a lot of, but not the complete effect.
Right.
And so they just took these two amino acids and then they duplicated it to kind of copy the structure of BDNF binding with another BDNF molecule as it does. And so they just duplicated it. And then they found that, you know, it has a lot of the effects of BDNF. So it can increase synapses. It can help neurons last longer by preventing apoptotic signals. So we'll, you know, get rid of those, as well as have help neurotransmitters go to the forefront of neural activity. So they are ready to be released. And the increase in synapses and the ability to reduce apoptosis, those two things were needed to elicit a antidepressant response. So I, you know, a few years later, I managed to get the substance, and people have been taking it, and they've had some very interesting reports. I have personally learned a lot about people's brains and just how different they can be. Yeah. You know, you don't really imagine so many left field occurrences to happen, you know, just straight out of the blue. And you think, wow, where did that come from? And BDNF and GSB106 is one of those things. So people reported having a higher heart rate with GSB whilst getting a kind of depersonalization, antidepressant, anti-anxiety effect. But it and some people had a much higher heart rate, and I was very surprised, and they couldn't take it any longer despite getting benefits, antidepressant benefits. So, you know, that was a shame.
Was that noted in the rat studies or any in the preliminary studies at
no,
all?
No, it wasn't. No, no, not at all. Because the reason being, I think, is, you know, human beings vary so much. And although I think it does increase their heart rate slightly in the normal rats, and, you know, I think it does for pretty much everyone who takes GSB, it will probably increase the heart rate a little bit. But the people where it increases it a lot are perhaps individuals, from what I found, these are people who've had chronic stress disorders. Yeah. And it seems to be that the brain just suddenly interprets the BDNF signal, the primary learning, the primary structurally changing kind of neurohormone. It interprets this change, this hormone, as being something where it could be bad. And it says high heart rate, stress, and it even increased anxiety in some people. So I think that the very identity of BDNF is different between people. And the BDNF can mean having lower depression, or it could mean a stress response. And your brain kind of flares up with this anxiety at the idea of changing almost, you know, and that's really, really interesting. I have personally taken a really, really, really high dose of GSB because I think things like cannabis, for example, that will change your BDNF system, and it can land up down-regulating a lot of the BDNF receptors and things. And that's very problematic, of course. So when I took it and I had a normal dose and I didn't get anything, and then I had five times the normal dose, and then 50 times the normal dose, and I still didn't get anything. And then when I had 100 times the normal dose, then I finally got something. And I felt like this. Yeah, people were saying, oh, dude, are you crazy? You know, they were checking up on me. Wow. But yeah, I mean, I'd had quite a bit beforehand and didn't notice anything. But I got this really kind of personal, almost like a really deep rooted sense of relaxation, and that things would be okay. You know, at the time I just had like £400 taken from me from PayPal, and I was quite anxious and stressed. And I thought, you know, you bastards, can I swear on here? Oh gosh.
It's fine, man. It's fine. Yeah.
Cool. I should have checked, but I was very angry at that day. And when I had the GSB, I went out to the shops and I completely forgot about those worries. I just didn't, they weren't on my mind hovering over me, you know, in the way that stress does to stop us from being as happy as we can in the moment. And I realized, oh, hang on, I literally haven't thought about it. Mm. And that was remarkable in a sense, but I was very, very relaxed and I felt much more at ease.
Mm. Yeah. Was the GSB also administered orally or?
Yes. So it has been administered orally. However, it's not very efficient, but the Russian scientists have this method that they tried out with Neurpept and a lot of other dipeptides and creations of theirs to see if they could enhance its ability to be absorbed orally. And it didn't work with Neurpept, and it didn't work with a lot of other things, but it did work with GSB. Mm. So much so that it became far, far more potent. It became 10 times more potent, or actually 50 times more potent, if you consider the power of effect, right? So it just became way better at causing the antidepressant effect. And that's because it manages to disperse the GSB all across the brain. So you end up getting a little bit of BDNF all across the brain. And that's perfect, really. And that could be why there was such a pronounced antidepressant effect. Hopefully, you know, if I have a bit of monetary freedom, I will develop that oral GSB, which would be incredible. And I can't imagine, you know, Russia would be very angry if I did, because they're not angry at people selling C-Max. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So you can buy it on my website, by the way. Anyone's watching.
I was about to ask, so where can people, find these compounds and things like that? Because they're very novel and they're hard to obviously source. So tell us more about where they can find these compounds.
Yeah. So it is pretty difficult to manufacture. You can't just go to a normal peptide lab to do it. And I noticed that, I noticed a peptide vendor that was selling it, and they were selling, 50 milligrams for like $800. And that's quite expensive. You know, that could potentially only be 100 doses, which is, expensive. But they can buy it on Holistic Research for a much cheaper price. You can get 100 milligrams for $500. Or if you want to buy less than 100 milligrams or more than 10 milligrams, then come to me and I'm sure we can work something out. You know, I understand that some people are in financial difficulties at the moment. So, yeah, but I've got the certificates of analysis and all that stuff as well. So yeah, try it out, see if it works for you. You know, some people don't seem to notice an effect from it, which is unfortunate, but I think it's the nose problem, you know, the enzymes in the nose that break it down too quickly.
Yeah.
But the correct dosage is, you know, between 200 and 1000 milligrams, but some people take 100 micrograms. Sorry, 200 micrograms to 1000 micrograms. And some people, they seem to get too much of an effect from 100 micrograms. So it's a bit up in the air, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an interesting compound. Definitely go and check it out.
I will definitely make sure to have them linked in the show notes. I'll have a chat with you after the show. just one question that came up as we're discussing the GSB, and it's mentioned across many clinical studies, and that's basically to analyze and assess the antidepressant effects of compounds, they use the forced swimming test. So do you want to explain what that is?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's kind of based on the idea that your level of happiness or your, you know, level of depression, you know, is based on how much effort you can put in to a difficult task. So the fundamental idea is like, if you have something difficult that is stopping you from doing something that you think is necessary, how much will you put up a fight?
Wow.
How much fighting power do you have in you? That's kind of the idea of the forced swimming test.
To me, that sounds like more of like incentive motivation more so than like, you know what I mean?
Hmm. Yeah, it's true. I'd say to rats, something necessary is like, you know, being able to move around or being able to you know, breathe, keep your head above water, or to find somewhere where you don't have to constantly struggle. So like the ability to evade struggling is like what it is to rats. Of course, like people have very different things facing them, very different problems. So, you know, if you're going to use an animal model, then yeah, you have to kind of really take things down to their core functions and things. But with it does sound much more like motivation, really. But with a lot of rats, when, you know, fear is a huge tool, basically, mm-hmm. and they land up just always running away from fear. There's barely any prefrontal cortex there to make them do otherwise. So if you've, you know, give them some kind of stressor, then they kind of treat that as if it's a fear. But the forced swimming test is essentially seeing how long they will swim when they can't move. Is that right? Yeah, I sometimes get them muddled up.
I think so, yeah. Oh, there's so, the other one's the tail suspension test. That's like the other one I think they use as well.
Yeah, that's another one, true. And like the platform, hidden platform test as well, tests their ability to remember.
I think it's things. the Morris water maze or something.
Yes, there it is. Yeah, see, awful with names even for testing. But yeah, I think when we talk about these tests, we have to remember what it's like to be the rat, right? You have to think as if you are the rat, okay? And a lot of times they'll test something called like the novelty seeking test, right? And then if a rat comes across an object that it has seen before, right? If it's seen it before, then you would expect it not to investigate that object a lot because it's already seen it before. So it's not going to go up to it and sniff it and see what it's like. But if you have something that increases curiosity, then it may check it out again. It may have not gone to the other side. It may have remembered, hey, I didn't go to the other side of that object, you know? So I sometimes have a bit of a squabble with, you know, these ideas about measuring rats, because a lot of the time they may, like sometimes they measure how often rats climb or try to climb out of the enclosure that they're in. And, you know, that's sometimes interpreted as just this irrelevant behavior. You know, you'll keep it in there in the graph, but it's not necessarily something that's used as a significant indicator. They don't say, yes, the rat was climbing much more often, so it clearly had, you know, more fear of the enclosure that it was in, or it had more motivation to go out and see the world, or it wanted to go to and apply to a job. You know, there are so many different ways you can interpret behaviors of animals. And sometimes I think they may not suffice, but the ability for rats to continue working in the face of struggling, then that is generally considered to be a way of measuring how depressed they are.
Wow.
And but there's another problem with that, in that if you're restricting their movements and you're measuring how hard they're trying to move, then if you gave them a muscle enhancer, then they would work all the time. They'll be fidgeting around, constantly moving their muscles. So it doesn't quite work. There's a peptide from spinach, and it enhances glucose uptake. Oh, do you know it? I think the owner of Nootropics Depot had it at one point, and he said he was too scared.
Rubiscolin.
Yeah, thank you. Rubiscolin. Oh. Yes, that's it. And you can see on the antidepressant effect, it's really, really high. I mean, these rats were constantly moving. They were struggling all the time. They were just had so much bountiful efforts to get out of their restrictions. But of course, it helps glucose be uptaken into muscles.
Yeah.
And it also has antidepressant effects by being opioidetic in nature. So you get this kind of muddling of the effects, which is irritating. But it is a really cool idea as to what you could do to enhance muscle function. Mm. You know, glucose uptake is pretty freaking cool.
Yeah.
Who knows? You can make a Superman pill or something that made you super strong.
Yeah.
That would be incredible, you know.
Jacob, you sort of briefly mentioned we'll finish, this will be our last topic, because I'll definitely have you back on the show, because we're going to have to do like more of these, or we might even do some Facebook Lives or Facebook, we'll just repost them and stuff. I want to touch on fear extinction, because I want to see what you know in that realm.
Oh my. I can't say this is a big topic of mine, but I know that the one thing that comes to my mind when I think of fear extinction is its relevancy to analyzing the efficacy of nootropics. If something gets rid of your fear, then it could do that in so many different ways. What did you say? Fear? It was fear, getting rid of fear, right? What was the terminology used again? Fear extinction.
Fear extinction, yeah. Yeah.
Some things look as though they are getting rid of fear, and you say, oh, this is, you know, reducing their amygdala activity or something, but they may be stopping memory from working. It may mean that they are forgetting why they should be afraid of that thing in front of them. Of course, sometimes you get stimuli that don't need any memory. They can just eradicate fear. But, you know, I think in terms of a cognitive perspective, it's not a very good way of measuring, you know, even emotionality, even the ability to regulate your own fear. Because if you give rats benzodiazepines, they won't be as scared, right? They'll just be dulled. So they'll just be pretty inhibited and they won't really care much. And you can, you know, some of the tests are the open field test is one way of measuring anxiety levels. And if you're meant to sort of plop them down in the middle of a bunch of routes, so like corridors, and if they walk into a corridor, then it means they like being in the enclosed space and they feel more safe in the enclosed space. And if you give them benzodiazepines, you put them in the middle, and they just stay in the middle of the corridors, which is in big open space where there could be predators flying over and things. And that they just sort of sit there thinking, oh, I've got so many different options. You know, I don't really think I need one of these options. I might just roll around, you know, and that's pretty funny. But I think fear extinction is very useful. I can see how it does relate to our modern day lifestyles. You know, it's definitely true that we have these micro fears that just come up when we're making decisions that are small or large, and we realize, oh, I don't want to face that struggle, so I'm just not going to approach it at all. So I can see a big relevancy there, but I don't think it should be characterized in the way that we characterize normal fear. And I think when you delve into these more sophisticated elements of human behavior, then it's more difficult to test animals with drugs to see if it will translate to humans. Because especially with these things of, you know, how we approach fearful events can be very sophisticated. Mm. And, you know, I think it would be more helpful to, I mean, I'm a molecular neuroscientist. I, of course, just love going from the bottom up kind of thing. You know, I like looking at the molecules and seeing what we can rely on, when in reality it's very difficult to rely on a molecule when they're interacting with 20, you know, 50, 100 billion neurons that are all interconnected in networks that complicate everything. But, you know, personally, You know, I think our ability to adapt to things and to process them properly, like when we are scared, we just refuse to process them. And if we, you know, open up the ability to process things before you even realize you're afraid, or before you allow the fear to take over, or if you just stop the fear from happening at all, which is a more risky way, I think, of approaching things. If you just stop fear itself, then, you know, you may land up with unwanted effects. But if you allow the brain to just process things without getting afraid, but just to process them anyway, then I think that's a really, that's the kind of thing that I work towards, for example, with GSB. You know, that's mimics BDNF, and BDNF just allows things to happen without there being, I can speak from a psychological perspective at least, and as well as a molecular, but it would be a different explanation. But, you know, I think that it allows the stress resilience to be far stronger and for people not to interpret things as being emotionally salient, right? And that they're not necessarily something that you have to get worked up about or fearful of, but it's something that you can process anyway and then decide your response later on. And the like yoga and things, I've heard lots of middle-aged women talk about how it helps them be resilient to stress, and it increases things, you know, exactly BDNF and nerve growth factor.
Yeah.
And it, you know, and I tell people that it does these things, and they say, wow, that makes perfect sense. You know, and my husband tells me I'm a fool for doing yoga because he perceives it as just a form of exercise that's done very slowly and therefore a really bad form of exercise, you know, when it's not. It's that slow movement that's, well, you know, it's for loads of reasons, but, you know, yeah. And I would be really interested to know if you find things that help combat, you know, fear and improve fear extinction and help us in a cortical way, you know, not just sort of dumb down our senses, but help us manage ideas that are kind of risky, you know.
It is a complex topic. The one sort of pathway that comes to my mind is the it's brought up quite a lot on the Reddit forums. It's the histone HDAC inhibitor, like sodium valproate.
Yeah, that's a huge topic.
Yeah, all those things. But we'll probably have to save that for another episode, man. Because we'll cluster it into another podcast. But Jacob, where can people? So obviously, I want my listeners to be able to follow your content, your products, whatever it is. So do you want to, you know, mention where they can find your, anything of your stuff, you know?
Yeah. Great. Thank you for, reminding me. So I've got my own website, my web store where you can purchase my products. I wouldn't recommend people dive into buying hyaluronate FGL because it's very risky and we still need to get some more information on it. If you're very experienced and learnt, then talk to me. But yeah, I have a Facebook group called Plasti.City Nootropics. It's plasticity with a dot before the city.
So good.
And I really, really like my group. It needs to be a bit more active. But yeah, that was born out of the frustration with like a lack of innovation, you know, a lack of the desire for discovery, for new things. So that's where we talk about new ideas, new inventions, and it's, you know, it's got things there that you can't find anywhere else. So definitely go join Plasticity Nootropics. My website is called holisticresearch.com with a WH for holistic, not a W, sorry, an HO. So yeah, go look at that. I've spent a lot of time writing the articles for the products that we have there, for some of them at least. Not some others, but yeah, that there's a lot of detailed information there in some ways. And I'm always responding to emails. So if you have any questions about any of the products or any questions at all, really, including the potential for using electrical and magnetic stimulation, which, you know, I hope we'll get around to in another podcast because that'll be really fun. Yeah. I look forward to that. And you know, you'll find me around in the nootropics groups as well. You can type my name in on the search bar and see what potentially rude but informative things I may have said.
But
thank you for asking, and thanks for having me on the show. It's been really fun,
and for me this is like I'm learning at the same time. We're sharing ideas, and I've got other business ideas that I've got to discuss with you, because like some of this stuff really excites me, in particular because There's not many people in this space that really know their stuff. You definitely, like, you tick those boxes, man. And I'm just glad that we connected, because I can definitely see us, you know, you never know, doing something in the future. So,
It's true. I look forward to those kinds of things as well. And I'm glad to discuss and pursue opportunities like that. And of course, I'd love to do them with yourself, you know, someone who knows a lot about the body more than I do, I'm sure, you know, testosterone as well. Really interesting stuff. I have learned a lot from your thinking as well. Like vitamin D, for example, I took some vitamin D like an hour ago, and it's sort of 10 p.m. here right now. And I was thinking of your article about how, you know, that's genius thinking right there, right? I mean, your body getting so much vitamin D in a late time in the day is you know, going to be counterintuitive. So yeah, I'd be really glad to do things with you. Definitely. That sounds exciting.
Cool. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in to yet another episode of the Boost Your Biology podcast. Just a massive, massive privilege and pleasure to have you on the show, Jacob.
Thanks it's so been much. A privilege as well, of course. On my side, I'm very grateful. I'm really appreciative. I'm so glad you reached out. It's a brilliant idea. And I look forward to talking to you about your stuff, as well as pursuing some ideas and things.
Thank you everyone for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.